We've got inflation, consumer spending, new home sales, and GDP. It's a pre-Thanksgiving feast of economic data out there, without the food coma. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Ryssdal. It is Wednesday, November 24th. Good to have you with us. One way a lot of us start our days here at Marketplace is with a glance at the economic calendar. On a typical day, there are just a few items: government data coming out, scheduled speeches by Fed officials, that sort of thing. Today, I counted 17 entries, an early data dump before the holiday. A lot of it was positive. Revised GDP growth was 2.1% in the third quarter, slightly better than previously estimated. Minutes from the Fed's recent open market committee meeting released today show the central bank staff is expecting sizable gains in GDP this year and next. And there's more. Household spending was up in October, and first-time unemployment claims were just 199,000, the lowest they've been since the pandemic began. But get this, the Labor Department said that's also the lowest they've been since 1969. Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports on how much that last one really tells us about this economy.
The fewest first-time unemployment claims in more than 50 years?
My first reaction is, wow.
Mark Hamrick is a senior economist at Bankrate. Despite his own initial reaction, he says it's also true that a single week of unemployment numbers doesn't really tell us all that much, nor does comparing today's economy to the one back then.
The economy has obviously been massively transformed since 1969. And so this just tells you that it's not very often that we see a new jobless claims number that has a one handle on it.
But even though it is just one week of data that could well be adjusted upwards later, it does fit into the big picture trend. The number of people who are unemployed is dropping.
The recovery so far has been relatively strong.
Gregory Dacko is with Oxford Economics.
But we are seeing a number of labor supply constraints that are preventing employment growth from being stronger.
Those constraints are ones we're all pretty familiar with at this point. Concerns about COVID, childcare issues, and a lot of early retirements. Plus, Dacko says, fewer immigrants being allowed into the U.S. for jobs.
I think on all fronts, we're starting to see signs that some of these constraints are easing.
But the economy is still volatile. Patricia Anderson, an economics professor at Dartmouth, says when it comes to interpreting all of the different employment data,
I think we mostly have to guess.
There's still a lot that's unclear about what is really happening in the labor market. Particularly, Anderson says, why so many people are quitting their jobs and not necessarily taking new ones.
The short answer seems to be a lot of people more or less saying, I don't need this crap. The question is, how can they get away with that?
And for how long? And what will it take to lure them back to the job market? I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
It wouldn't be an economic data dump without new inflation numbers. A key measure of inflation, called the Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index from the Commerce Department, was up 0.6% in October. That's the monthly increase. Compared to October of last year, prices are up 5%, and that's the fastest pace of growth in more than 30 years. Now, having an official number to gauge inflation is helpful, but what about how people are feeling about their spending power on the cusp of a pretty big shopping weekend? Marketplace's Andy Euler has that story.
It's part of Liz Young's job to track these economic data from the government. She's head of investment strategy at SoFi. She's also getting ready for Thanksgiving at her place in downtown Manhattan.
I tried to order a turkey and it was going to be over $100. So, that was a raw turkey, not even cooked. So that was just to get one in my apartment.
Government data show the price of food as a whole has risen 4.8% since last year.
On the bright side, wage inflation has also gone up. So it's a little bit easier to absorb from that perspective.
The Department of Commerce says personal spending rose 1.3% in October. Dan Sickle, a former Federal Reserve Board staffer who now teaches economics at Wellesley College, says it's because the supply chain's working out some kinks.
There was a much bigger than expected accumulation of inventories by businesses suggesting that they're able to get goods. Because if they can get goods on the shelves, then people can start buying them.
And people are using their savings to do it. Eric Friedman with U.S. Bank Asset Management Group says people were putting pandemic benefits into savings accounts. Now that that assistance is gone,
will we see people migrate back into the labor force because their stockpile, if you will, of government benefits and other savings is starting to diminish over time? That's going to be the key thing that we focus on to see, again, that next leg of growth, if there is one that follows what we're seeing right now.
He says it appears that consumers will continue to spend for now, but if inflation doesn't decline at the same rate as Americans' savings accounts, it could be a problem for growth. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
And one more note from the Fed minutes, a little bit of Fed speak on what Andy just talked about. Here's a quote. Participants were attentive to the sizable increase in the cost of living that had taken place this year and the associated burden on U.S. households. Yes, inflation is on the minds of everyone. Well, maybe not everyone. On Wall Street today, more up than down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Stepping away from the data now to another kind of labor story, the pandemic has highlighted how essential caregiving is to people's lives and to the economy. And yet, the people who do this work are often paid low wages and denied basic protections. The U.S. Department of Labor is trying to address some of these concerns for home-based healthcare workers. It's launched a new education, outreach, and enforcement initiative aimed at protecting workers' rights. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more.
There are more than 2 million home-based personal and healthcare workers assisting seniors and people with disabilities in the U.S. The vast majority of them are women, disproportionately women of color and immigrants, making an average of $13 an hour, according to Lul Tesfai with New America.
Nearly half of all home care workers live in a low-income household, and one of six workers lives below the federal poverty line.
They can be hired through state-run registries, private agencies, or often just informal networks, says Emil Dovtyan, an employment attorney in Los Angeles.
Very just commonplace for workers to get abused because they get paid by cash a lot of times.
Like most domestic workers, home care aides had historically been excluded from federal job protections like overtime pay under the Fair Labor Standards Act. But the Obama administration moved to include them in 2015. Actually, applying the law, though, can be challenging, says Caitlin Connolly with the National Employment Law Project.
Many times workers are going directly to people's homes and aren't, in fact, meeting at a central workplace, talking with other coworkers.
It's also not always clear who the employer responsible is when workers are hired by an individual but paid through an agency. That's why outreach efforts need to target both groups, says the Department of Labor's Jessica Luman.
We're doing an employer association-focused outreach. We are doing advocacy outreach for advocates who represent these types of workers.
Last year, the division recovered almost $40 million in back wages for healthcare workers. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
We are not out of the woods yet with the supply chain tie-up still causing havoc in this pandemic. And some small businesses that rely on this speedy delivery of time-sensitive products have had to get creative. Elizabeth Dunham is vice president of Night Hollow Nursery in Middleton, Wisconsin. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So how is the nursery business doing during this pandemic? Plants have been pretty popular, judging from my social media feeds.
Yeah, that's right. Our nursery has done really well through this pandemic. I think people are sitting at home and looking out their window and saying, boy, you know, we could really use another tree or shrub or, you know, a vegetable or something in this garden that we have so much more time to play in.
Yes. And yet there's this other big issue going on for many businesses, supply chain problems. What have you had trouble getting, and how has that affected your ability to get your product out to customers?
We have had some problems getting pots. Anything plastic is a problem. Our chemicals can be hard to source lately. However, our main problem has been logistics as far as shipping our plants out.
Yeah, tell me about that. Is it hard to and more expensive to ship these days?
It's definitely more expensive. And we are trying to ship more in bulk so that it's more cost effective for our customers. However, that makes it kind of cutthroat when it comes to actually shipping a huge amount of product all at once, especially for a live product.
Well, and talk about what happens to a live product. I mean, how long do you have? How much wiggle room and delays do you have before the plants just die?
Right. There's not a lot of wiggle room. And we have a lot of customers in Oregon, and we're in Wisconsin. So you're looking at a 3 to 4 day ship time as it is. And last year we had a couple pallets that got out to the West Coast within a reasonable time, but they get loaded on the truck for delivery and the FedEx employee wouldn't come in. So our plant sat on the truck over the weekend and we lost a fair amount of product.
Oof.
We also had a pallet going out to New Jersey and it ended up going rail because they didn't have any trucks to ship the plants that way. The car got to New Jersey within a week or something, and they didn't have anybody to actually unload the product from the rail car. So it sat on the car for 2 weeks, and it was all dead, of course.
It just hurts to think of all those dead plants, having killed a few myself unintentionally.
Yeah, we're good at that, too. Just try not to.
Do you just get over that as someone who does this professionally?
You do. And I always say it's nice to work with plants because they don't talk back. I mean, you can see them if they're hurting, but they don't actually yell at you.
So the pandemic has been all about pivoting for small businesses, sometimes pivoting multiple ways. What solutions have you come up with to deal with the shipping issues?
Right. So normally we would plan our scheduling for our production of plants, and then we'd sort of piecemeal those out as they become ready. However, this year we've had to grow all these different plants at the same time for our West Coast customers. And instead of relying on FedEx or UPS, we decided that we're going to rent a truck this year and we're going to send an employee out because then we know it's going to get there. We know that they're going to be in good care and he's going to take them out and deliver them all around the Portland area. And that's a huge pivot for us. I mean, normally we wouldn't do that.
That's quite a road trip. How many plants are we talking about?
Well, we're talking somewhere around 50,000 plants.
Wow.
So it's a huge value for the company for us to get them delivered on time. There's no way that I can rely on the other freight companies to do that. For right now, we're just going to take it into our own hands and drive it out there ourselves.
Elizabeth Dunham is vice president of Night Hollow Nursery in Middleton, Wisconsin. Thanks so much.
Yes. Thanks for talking to me.
Coming up.
So we're looking at exposed concrete here.
The latest design trend or a safety problem. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 9 points, call it unchanged, to finish at 35,804. The NASDAQ picked up 70 points, 0.4%, to end at 15,845. And the S&P 500 picked up 10 points, about 0.25%, to land at 4701. There in that torrent of economic data that came pouring out today was better than expected news about consumer spending. It was up 1.3% in October, the biggest jump since March. And even once you factor in inflation, which Andy Euler was telling us about, consumer spending still outpaced projections. From the On the Other Hand desk, consumer sentiment is at its lowest in about a decade, according to the University of Michigan, because consumers are worried about, you guessed it, inflation. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.63%. You're listening to Marketplace.
The
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. John Deere posted a 69% increase in profits today for its fourth quarter. That's despite a labor strike that started in mid-October and ended last week. More than 10,000 workers had joined the fight for better wages and benefits. It was the first major strike in the agriculture sector in three decades and part of a wave of labor activity in recent months. Tracking that activity, though, isn't always straightforward, which is why we reached out last week to Johnny Callis, director of the relatively new Labor Action Tracker at Cornell University. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Amy. Good to be with you.
So why did we need this tracker? What sets it apart from existing resources?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So we started this project because there are considerable limitations with existing data sources when it comes to documenting strike activity. So, for example, the Bureau of Labor Statistics has only documented strikes involving 1,000 or more employees that last an entire shift. So you could imagine this leaves out the vast majority of strike activity. So because of that, we decided to take on this project to try and create a more accurate database.
So I've got the tracker open for folks who want to check it out. It's striketracker.ilr.cornell.edu. And there's a map of the United States with little circles showing a lot of activity in places you might suspect, in the Northeast, the Midwest, the West Coast. But there are kind of holes in the country where there isn't a lot of activity. What do you think that says about the labor movement in the United States?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And one thing we want to do is obviously show that geographic distribution. I do think that union membership is often concentrated in certain parts of the country, such as the Northeast, Midwest, and West Coast, where you may see increased strike activity. That being said, we've also documented a fair amount of labor activism in the South and in places where maybe there isn't as much of a historical union presence.
So I want to zoom in on one here. There's a single event in the state of Utah at Redstone 8 Cinemas, Metropolitan Theaters, and there were just 8 workers. This was not a union strike, and it looks like they were striking for a $15 minimum wage. Tell us about, you know, where this information comes from and what the resolution was.
So this is one of the only, maybe the only actually strike we've documented in Utah so far in 2021. And it was really interesting because, as you said, it's a non-union strike involving 8 workers, but it lasted 2 weeks. We track information related to the employers. We also track industry and also the demands, which, as you said, were related to pay and a $15 minimum wage. I believe what happened in this situation is workers didn't achieve the $15 minimum wage, but they did get a $2 an hour wage increase. And it demonstrates that even workers who don't belong to a union have been engaging in this sort of labor activism.
And I was pleased to see your source for that data was KPCW, the local public radio station.
Yeah, of course. And we like to place our sources on the maps. So we have certain verification protocols. So for the most part, we try and list at least 2, if not more, sources that demonstrate that both the strike or the protest happened. And everything that you see on our map comes from those public sources. That's where we generate all our information from.
If you look at the map and the numbers, you've tracked over 300 strikes this year, if I'm reading it correctly. Compared to the BLS, which has, I think, just 13 work stoppages, that's involving more than 1,000 workers. Why do you think it's important to see activity on a smaller scale?
Yeah, and I should say, so we actually list the number of strike locations, which is slightly higher than the number of strikes. So, for example, you could have a single strike like at John Deere at multiple locations. So, but as you said, it's a huge difference with what the BLS has tracked. So, for example, there's been an ongoing strike by over 700 nurses at St. Vincent Hospital in Worcester, Massachusetts since March 8th of this year. So that's a strike involving over 700 nurses during a global pandemic. That's really significant. It's not captured at all in the BLS data.
Johnny Callis directs the Labor Action Tracker at Cornell University. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Take care.
All all those roads and bridges due to be repaired under the $1 trillion Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act will take a beating over the next few days. AAA is predicting close to pre-pandemic levels of travel this Thanksgiving weekend, most of it by car. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer will be among those crawling through traffic on the East Coast, and she went to check out some of the infrastructure along her route to see what kind of shape it's in and where some of that new money might go. Here's Nancy.
To go over the river and through the woods to grandmother's house, you have to cross a bridge. Lots of bridges in my family's case. We'll be traveling the busy corridor between the Washington, D.C. area and upstate New York. I tend to worry about things. So it's time for a bit of a dry run, just the first leg of our trip. I'm heading toward Baltimore to meet someone from the American Road and Transportation Builders Association, a construction trade group.
Take the exit.
As of March of this year, there were around 10 interstate bridges in Maryland deemed structurally deficient, according to the Builders Association. Michael Cicada heads the association's Maryland chapter.
Yes, how are you doing?
Cicada and I are meeting at the 60-year-old Putty Hill Avenue Bridge, which my family and I will go under during our trip. The bridge looks terrible. There are big chunks missing from the sidewalk. Cicada runs bits of sand and gravel through his fingers.
This is definitely the structure, the guts of the material. If you look at these rocks, which are used to create the concrete. So we're looking at exposed concrete here. Yeah, which is not good.
Can we go underneath it?
I tried going over there. I wasn't able to.
I want to look under the bridge because I'm wondering if, say, a chunk of it could fall off and smash through a windshield. Cicada explains that a structurally deficient bridge isn't necessarily unsafe. The sidewalk of this bridge is crumbling and the roadway has been patched many times, but the skeleton underneath is okay. Cicada says state engineers regularly inspect bridges, steel and concrete substructures for cracks. Those would not be okay.
You know, if the bridge, to your point, is unsafe, it will be closed.
That's reassuring. Back at home on a Zoom call with economist Diana Furchtkott-Roth, there's more reassuring news. Furchtkott-Roth is a former Department of Transportation economist, now teaching at George Washington University. She says Maryland can expect about $400 million worth of infrastructure money for bridge repair and replacement. But what about the rest of the trip?
You're also going to be driving through Delaware.
That's right.
And Delaware can expect to receive $225 million for bridge replacement and repairs.
New Jersey and New York will get hundreds of millions more. Good thing, because we'll be driving on Interstate 80, which has two structurally deficient bridges in New Jersey as of March of this year. Furchtkott-Roth says New York has its problems, too.
In New York, there's 1,702 bridges and over 7,292 miles of highway in poor condition.
So state officials have a miles-long to-do list, but construction won't start for a while, says Byron Brown, a lawyer and lobbyist at the Washington law firm Crowell and Mooring.
So you could see projects that start being built, or ground being broken over the next couple of years that could continue for 5 or 6 years into the future.
Brown would like the construction to start sooner. He could very well be on the road, too, this Thanksgiving. He's thinking about driving up to New Jersey. I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
And this final note on the way out today, the word of the year, according to Collins Dictionary, is actually an abbreviation for three words, non-fungible token, NFT. And if you haven't yet figured out exactly what that is, ask a youngster at your Thanksgiving dinner. Or here's Collins's definition: a unique digital certificate registered in a blockchain that is used to record ownership of an asset, such as an artwork or a collectible. The publisher attributed the choice to NFT's, quote, meteoric rise in usage, up 11,000% in 2021. Other contenders were double vaxxed, neo-pronoun, and Chugi. I definitely had to look that last one up, which turns out is pretty apt. Okay, your moment of economic context today. I promised you home sales, so here they are. Sales of new homes rose 0.4% last month to an annual rate of 745,000. That's lower than expected, with high prices and low supply continuing to be a drag on sales. But standard caveat, these numbers have a huge margin of error and get revised all the time. Case in point, September sales were revised sharply downward from 800,000 to 742,000. The median price of new homes sold last month, a record $407,700. I'm Amy Scott, and we will be back tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.